Maybe this has happened to you. At the grocery store, you bump the shopping cart of another person with your cart. You apologize. The other person says it's all right. There are a few giggles and everyone moves on. We're still polite in most dealings with other people in person. Online, all bets are off. We say terrible things to each other on social media and comment areas. Blame technology if you want, but the technology's not going away. So how do we deal with our incivility in the years ahead? Caitlin Ugolik-Phillips takes up the issue in the book The Future of Feeling, Building Empathy in a Tech-Obsessed World. Caitlin Ugolik-Phillips is a journalist and editor who writes on law, finance, health, and technology. Her work has appeared in Vice and Quartz, among others, and Caitlin also publishes a blog and newsletter about empathy. Caitlin, I know you've been on a busy tour for the book. Thanks for joining us and spending some time with us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
So break it to us quickly. Do you find much empathy in the world today?
Sure. I mean, we still have empathy. I think it's getting a little harder to access it, maybe.
Okay, so let's talk about the ways in which we, or the places in which we demonstrate how we're doing with empathy. Facebook is one, for example, and you say it simultaneously feels like a yearbook and a battlefield. Mm-hmm. Tease that out for us.
Sure, yeah, so especially a few years ago when I was really starting to get the idea for this book, it felt like, you know, I would log on to Facebook and I would see, you know, things that were going on with people from high school who I hadn't talked to in a while, distant cousins, et cetera, and then also raging political debates and debates about cultural things that would get really nasty really fast. So it was kind of this weird dichotomy going on there.
Really nasty, really fast, and really lengthy, I noticed, that if one person posts something and making fun of somebody else's political idol, bam, that seems to go to like 30 or 40 comments in no time at all.
Mm-hmm. Especially if you're in a larger group, which a lot of people are using Facebook more now for the groups. You know, if you're in a group of a few thousand people, it pretty quickly can go from, you know, one post to 30, 40 comments, and then you suddenly have all these notifications. A lot of people now, I notice, just will kind of delete their posts instead of dealing with all of that.
Wow. There's an opening vignette in the book about you posting on Facebook about Michael Brown, who, of course, was shot dead by police in Ferguson, Missouri. Got a huge response, but one above all others seems to really stick with you.
Yeah, so at that time, I and a lot of my friends were talking about things like police brutality with each other online and in person, just kind of learning about what was going on. And I had posted something saying, you know, what's going on in this police department in Ferguson? Like, how has this happened? And someone I hadn't spoken to in over a decade, who I had graduated from high school with, sent me a direct message with, you know, some of it was in all caps, kind of telling me, you know, I'm a police officer, you're not qualified to have an opinion about this. And it kind of shocked me for a few reasons, and then stuck with me. And later on, I kind of realized, you know, for a while I felt like, wow, how can this guy have so little empathy for what happened, you know, to this kid and his family? But then I kind of realized neither of us were having empathy for one another. We, in this space on Facebook, you know, kind of seemed like he felt entitled to come into my, you know, private message and say whatever he wanted and then leave. And then I, you know, didn't really take the time to feel empathy for where he was coming from because it was so heated and we were so riled up. And I think that's something that environment, that technology, social media environment fuels that. And while it connects you to people, it doesn't always make you feel like you have room to access empathy in a conversation.
And this is where we should point out that you've got a long experience with digital devices. You know, they came along when you were quite young. So, I mean, it sounds like you were an early adopter of chat rooms and things like that.
Yeah, I think as early as middle school, I was coming home from school and logging on. You know, at that time it was dial-up, so I had to wait and make sure no one was on the phone. But, you know, using AOL Instant Messenger with people I knew, and then some of the early chat rooms before things got really crazy. And then I used LiveJournal, MySpace, and then graduated to Facebook around the end of high school.
All right, so this is not a book about putting down devices permanently. That is clear. So what is the pathway just generally that you see ahead?
I see more intentionality and thoughtfulness about how we use these things. I think that for sure for some people, just completely detoxing, quote unquote, or, you know, removing themselves from these platforms has been the answer, but I don't really think that's realistic for a lot of us, especially those of us who grew up online, so to speak. And things are, you know, only moving in a more tech-obsessed direction, as I say in the book. I think, though, that this has kind of felt just like a natural progression for a lot of us, and almost like a, you know, slow boiling frog in water kind of situation where we didn't realize what was happening. And I think it's time to kind of step back and be a little more intentional and take a little more control of the way we use these platforms.
Do you have any issue with the empathy in person? I mean, are we still pretty civil to each other in person, as I outlined at the beginning?
Well, we're starting to see that with younger kids, there's a little bit of preliminary research that the more time spent, you know, using these devices, the more teachers and parents are kind of noticing that that empathy muscle isn't being strengthened in the way it should be at a young age. I think that, you know, always, you know, before technology, even some people have more empathy than others and are more kind. You know, there was always going to be someone who was going to bump into your shopping cart and be mean about it and someone who wouldn't. I think that part of what drove me to report and write this book was my fear that the more technology becomes integrated in our lives, the less we will be able to act on empathy in person. But I don't know that we're quite there yet.
Well, and in fact, there's at least one person who's not very high on the idea of going with empathy. Psychologist Paul Bloom, as you point out in your book, wrote a book called Against Empathy. Why would he be against empathy?
I think his research has shown him that, at least at the macro scale, from my understanding, so in terms of leading countries and organizations, that compassion specifically, so the act of kindness is more important than empathy. But I think, you know, there's room for both of our views to coexist there. I think that empathy and compassion are both important.
All right. We'll pick up the conversation on the other side of a break. The book by Caitlin Ugolik-Phillips is called The Future of Feeling, Building Empathy in a Tech-Obsessed World. Mull over the ways in which you think we can show more empathy to each other, either online or in person, and join our conversation by phone or email. We're back on the Jefferson Exchange with Caitlin Ugolik-Phillips and you in a minute 20. And you get into a subject in the book that it's a practice I've seen before. I didn't realize there was a name for it. It's the practice of what you call vague booking. What is that?
Yeah, so that's a word that's used for when someone is essentially being passive aggressive on social media, mostly on Facebook. You know, so kind of posting a picture, for example, of like their wrist with a medical bracelet on, and you're supposed to ask, oh no, what happened? Or, you know, it's also on Twitter called subtweeting, where you kind of write a tweet that's directed at a person without naming them, but kind of everyone can tell who you're talking about. So it's passive aggressive behavior on social media that's meant to get attention.
And it often has that effect, because I've noticed when people say, oh, I'm so mad at the world today. And then, of course, everybody responds, what is it, honey? Is that becoming passe at all? I mean, are people starting to catch on to it and not respond to it?
I think so. I think it's not as people don't fall for it quite as much. But that's one of the things that in some of the research that I saw on how social media affects teenagers. That was one thing where they didn't really see a correlation in the mental wellness of teenagers and their use of social media, except for when it came to things like vague booking, that if a kid was doing that behavior, then that was kind of a cry for help in a lot of situations.
Now, the use of the term vague booking in here is in a section about mental health and social media. And what do we have in the way of research that indicates how social media affects our mental health?
So right now we have some correlation that's being found, but we're kind of at the beginning of this area of research. And so it's still a new area. Researchers are pretty careful saying that there's causation, but there's a lot of anecdotal evidence that, you know, the more time people spend on social media, sometimes they've been shown to correlate with higher levels of narcissism, selfishness, and sometimes loneliness. But then you can also find research that says the opposite. So that's why I say that it's kind of a new area. I did just read about new methods of researching this connection that will potentially make the results more meaningful. So I think we'll be learning more about the impact in the near future.
There was something you said in the book that caught my eye, and it made it sound almost like social media is a bit of a sugar high, in the sense that if people are feeling isolated, it can actually help a bit, but then the feeling goes away quickly because there's no real people there.
Yeah, there's some research that shows that there is a short-term relief from loneliness, essentially, but the longer-term impact is less clear. So that kind of goes along with the fact that there's that dopamine rush that you get when you have a notification and you go to check it, or when you see that, you know, on your Instagram stories, there's a bunch of new stories for you to watch. You kind of get this literal, you know, neurotransmitter rush the same way that if you were, you know, at a slot machine and thinking you might be about to win something. But that's a short-lived experience, and your brain kind of gets trained to look for that and to yearn for that, and you kind of get immune in some cases to it. But on the longer term, it doesn't, you know, create a lasting sense of well-being.
I hadn't heard the slot machine reference before, but that's excellent, the idea of waiting there for somebody to like your stuff.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So, Caitlin, the tech industry is certainly aware of all this. It seems like the folks from Facebook certainly get hauled up in front of Congress on a fairly regular basis these days, but they don't seem to feel much need to do anything to minimize the damage.
Yeah, that's a problem that I tried to grapple with a little bit in the book, especially in the last chapter where I got on my soapbox a little bit about how there really are empathy gaps, and in some cases just a total lack of empathy in the way some of these platforms were built to begin with, and the way that the teams were assembled to create them. And I think that what's really going to help us moving forward is not necessarily depending on the existing platforms and their leaders to make huge changes that show they have empathy for their users. I mean, I think they're kind of being forced to make some changes, and we might see regulations that, you know, kind of require that. But I think it's going to be more about moving forward, making sure that we have more diverse teams creating the products in the future, and that the people who are creating the next wave of technology are thinking more about empathy, which, you know, from my research at least, it seems like there are. There's kind of a new wave of developers and technologists who are really concerned about this and are making that part of the foundation of their work.
You know, now that I think about it, Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook have some staying power because, you know, you talked about AOL Instant Messenger, gone. You talked about MySpace, gone, essentially. So Facebook has managed to have some staying power, oddly enough. We're in the middle age of social media here, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's partly because they were able to just get so many people onto the platform, like billions of people.
Yeah, that may be. We're talking to Caitlin Ugalik-Phillips here on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is The Future of Feeling, Building Empathy in a Tech-Obsessed World. So a poll, as you point out in the book, showed that 90% of Americans felt that the 2016 election season was more polarizing than the 2012 election season, and yet they still went online a lot, it sounds like.
Yeah, that was where a lot of the polarization came from, I think. There was some interesting research done right after the election where the researchers asked people, you know, about their experiences, and so many people said that they had, you know, negative experiences, even with friends and family members, but also with strangers. People said they stopped talking to people that they previously were friends with, and a lot of that was amplified by having conversations about this stuff online, especially on places like Facebook, in which we now know, you know, some of that might have been also amplified by the misinformation that was kind of running rampant on Facebook at the time, and the way that, you know, outside forces were able to manipulate people as well.
Yeah, I do remember in, I think it was the 2012 election when, you know, one of my Facebook friends showed up with a like for a candidate, and all of her friends were like, how could you like this person? She said, no, they got it wrong. But the fact is that people can have this knee-jerk reaction to something that isn't true without asking somebody first or checking.
Exactly. Yeah, and it's interesting how at the same time that we feel more entitled to know these things about our friends and family members because everyone posts everything online, then taking that next step, people don't feel as comfortable with, you know, so seeing someone post something, you feel like you have, you know, that entitlement to know with their political leaning, for example. But then if you see that they liked a candidate, you know, that you are surprised by, reaching out to them on a personal level and asking, hey, you know, what's going on? Like, is this true? Tell me what you think. That feels strange to people. That kind of intimacy doesn't feel right. That kind of empathy, we don't feel as comfortable with that anymore. And I think that's part of the problem.
So I get to own details of your life, but I don't get to talk to you about them or something.
It's something, or you know, it's fine for me to watch as, you know, parts of your life happen, but and you know, quietly judge you,
right.
Or publicly, you know, respond to you, but having an actual intimate conversation doesn't feel as comfortable.
So let's talk about Dylan Maron. This is a great story in your book. Who is he, and how did he turn things around with online trolls?
Dylan is an actor, an activist, and a YouTube person. He wears a lot of hats. He has this great podcast called Conversations with People Who Hate Me. I highly recommend listening to it. It's evolved in an awesome way over the last couple of years. And basically, he did some videos that were about things like he would do unboxing videos where he would kind of unpack in a satirical way different phrases like white privilege, police brutality. And he got a lot of comments from people who didn't like these things. Someone kind of rage at him, and he decided to start asking these people if they would be willing to have a recorded conversation with him. And in the first episode, which I write about in the book, he calls up this guy named Chris, who left a really nasty comment on one of his YouTube videos, and they just kind of get to know each other, find out that they actually have some things in common, and he tries to really understand where Chris is coming from. Now, this is like a extreme act of empathy, I think, on Dylan's part. You know, he felt comfortable and safe and, you know, emotionally prepared enough to do this and not knowing what was going to come out of it. But in listening to it is also a really interesting exercise in empathy, because as I write in the book, I don't feel sympathy for this person. I still disagree with him on a lot of things, but I sort of get a sense of where he's coming from in a way that I think better informs my view of the conversation than if I just assumed, you know, that I knew who this person was based on what he said in his comments. It's a really interesting exercise. And then being able to listen to it in a podcast form, I think, is also great, because you don't have that ability to have a knee-jerk response. You're just listening in your car or while you're on a walk, and you kind of are able to you know, safely kind of argue with yourself in your head without impacting anyone else.
All right, without your fingers on a keyboard ready to,
right.
to give a response, sure. We're talking to Caitlin Ugolik-Phillips, a journalist and editor here on the Jefferson Exchange, about her book, The Future of Feeling, Building Empathy in a Tech-Obsessed World, about how we can relate to each other in civil ways, even if we're not feeling terribly civil, and of course, if we're on social media, which doesn't really seem to value civility. You can join the conversation on the Exchange. Your thoughts, your comments, your questions, welcome. At 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. He dropped the question off and didn't stay on the line, but John in Grants Pass wanted to point out that The Oregonian, which is online as oregonlive.com, has removed the comment section. They do not allow people to comment anymore. And you write in the book about efforts at Michigan State and other places to create tech to steer online comments. What's that about?
Yes, that's been a really common response at a lot of news organizations, actually, to remove those comments just because they get out of hand and people don't have the resources to moderate them. So one project that has been created is essentially a moderating tool that I think is meant to be used in combination with actual human moderators, but that can kind of sense when a conversation might be going off the rails. And so it learns, it's a machine learning algorithm essentially that learns based on the information that you feed it from past comments and conversations, what kind of conversational moves and wording might trigger a, you know, 50 comment long thread where people are just being nasty to each other. And it's kind of in beta mode still, I think. I think there are probably a few websites that are using it. It was actually tested at my hometown paper here in Raleigh, North Carolina. And it's really interesting. I've used some similar technology where I think it was created by Google. And it's the same idea to eventually have something, I think, that would pop up and kind of warn people or let people know that what they're typing has been flagged as toxic in some way in the past. But it also currently lets you, you know, put in existing text and kind of analyzes it for you. So I had had a kind of heated conversation in a book Facebook group, which, you know, of all things. And I put the text into this machine and it color coded the different types of conversational moves, quote unquote, that were happening. And it essentially showed me that for the whole conversation, all of us just kept setting up and resetting up our points. And we were never really asking each other questions or responding. We just kept making our points over and over again. So I think the idea is that eventually if people are able to access that kind of thing and see sort of an analysis of the conversations that they're part of, either after the fact or in real time, that it might help people, you know, consider a little bit more before they respond. Or it might just make people more angry, you know?
Yeah, it might have that effect too, but I appreciate that what it appears to be doing is if not stalling, at least delaying us to say, is this really what you want to say?
And not censoring, because that's one thing that I think people are worried about with things like this. Another example is the neighborhood social network Nextdoor. They have a kindness reminder that's being tested, and it does pretty much the same thing. If you're typing some words that are in comments that have been reported by other users, it'll pop up and say exactly that and then give you the option to keep going. So this actually happened to me because someone asked for a recommendation for a church, and I was talking about various different churches and used words like Islam, Judaism, that sort of thing. And I guess in the past people have used those terms in slurs or in negative comments. And the kindness reminder said, hey, make sure that you're being kind. And so it was a little bit off because I was not being, you know, rude with those comments. I just happened to be using the same words. But I thought that was interesting that it flagged that. But it gave me the option, you know, to decide what to do next.
Mm-hmm. Caitlin Ugalik-Phillips, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is The Future of Feeling, Building Empathy in a Tech-Obsessed World. Let's take a call. Let's go to Josh in Weed. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. Josh, you there?
Hello. This is really interesting, but the reason I called is that I am a software developer who hasn't worked professionally in a while, and if you could put me in touch with somebody who's working on some kind of empathy-oriented software that I could work on, I'd be interested.
All right, let's see what Caitlin can offer in the way of it. Caitlin, any ideas for where Josh might turn to be able to help offer his services?
That's a good question. I just read about something called Block Party. That's a new type of it's a new technology that's aimed at fixing some of these problems. So you might check out Block Party. I think it's still in beta mode.
Mm-hmm.
If you just Google really like empathy and social media or empathy and technology startup, there are now, you know, there's kind of a wave of developers who are trying to get into this area. So I think there's probably a lot out there that you could join.
Josh, best of luck with that. Let me ask about Face the Future. This is an online multiplayer game, which is part of the effort to use software to get people to be nicer to each other. Who made it? What's it meant to do?
So this was a cool game that I kind of got to sit back and watch as it unfolded. It was created by the Institute for the Future in California. And they created this game that was meant to be played by students all around the world at the same time online. And it asked the students to kind of imagine that they lived in a world in the near future where there was a device that was as ubiquitous as a smartphone that would allow them to literally transmit their feelings to one another. So not just words about their feelings, but the literal feelings. And they made some videos to kind of depict what this would be like and ask the students to collaborate with each other and have conversations about what that would be like, the concerns they would have. And it was fascinating the things that these kids came up with. You know, some of them thought this would be amazing. It could help people who have trouble expressing empathy. It could, you know, solve, you know, it could create peace, essentially. But then other kids had the opposite concerns. It could start a war. You could start to discriminate against people based on their feelings, just the same way we do at a large scale based on, you know, income or race. But just having that conversation, that was the point of this game, was to get these kids to think about this. Because even though that technology doesn't exist currently, the some of the pieces that would make it up do. So that could be what we're in store for in the near future.
Okay, but here again, we're faced with the prospect of new technology coming in to see if it can right some of the problems created by earlier new technology. So
right.
This is the cycle we're in. This is Caitlin Ugalik-Phillips we're talking to on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is The Future of Feeling, Building Empathy in a Tech-Obsessed World. Lots more to talk about here. We'll get into virtual reality when we continue the discussion here on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Let's move into the area of virtual reality, because this is a rich vein that you've mined well in the book, Caitlin. Talk about some of the VR experiences that targeted empathy.
Yeah, virtual reality is being used a lot in this area. For a while, it was mostly used in video gaming, and now there are a lot of people creating content for it that is aimed for social action, social justice work, sometimes journalism, and there's a bunch of different ways that we can go at this, but I guess I'll start with, so organizations like Planned Parenthood have created experiences where you can put on the headset and kind of follow a person to see what it's like as they approach a clinic, and then as they're in the clinic room talking to a doctor, and as they leave, and you kind of hear real audio from protesters that is shouted at people outside of clinics, and the idea is to kind of just, make that story more real.
I want to point out, though, with the Planned Parenthood stuff, you pointed out that Planned Parenthood was careful to make sure that the things that people were screaming at the camera in the virtual reality experience were things that actually had been heard.
Yes. So, exactly. At the beginning, I think they use actors, but at the end, there is real audio from actual protests, but the visuals are cartoon. So it is real things that people have said, actual real audio, but that part is animated, which I thought was interesting, and I thought might have been to make it seem a little bit less real, because it might have been too upsetting to feel like you're really in that experience.
So is the idea then that people, because I can't imagine that, for example, somebody who feels strongly about opposing legalized abortion would ever get into that virtual reality scenario.
Right. So this is one of the potential weaknesses of virtual reality, building empathy. The way that you feel about something, your openness to it beforehand definitely plays a major role. They did find Planned Parenthood had an outside organization, I think, do a study of this experience and how people responded to it. And they did find that that people who already, supported them more, and people who were a little bit more conservative on this issue didn't, suddenly change their minds. But they did seem to soften a little bit toward the people who use these services. So there was one story told at an event I went to about this, that there was a conservative politician who, didn't really support Planned Parenthood, but after he took off the headset, he was really angry, and they asked him, what made you so angry? And it wasn't the Planned Parenthood information, it was how awful the protesters were being, and he didn't know that was an issue, and so now he does. So little things like that, just kind of like opening people's minds a little bit more just to others' experiences, I think that's really where the impact is with this.
It's interesting, though, because it's the same portion of the book where you point out that Silicon Valley executives tend to keep their own kids away from tech.
Yeah.
Tech like they make.
That is true. Tim Cook, I think, talks about his nephew. He doesn't really want him to have an iPhone. And that's definitely the case. I think that's really fascinating. I think it shows that they, in a lot of ways, understand the potential drawbacks of these technologies. And I don't know. It kind of makes you wonder, about about the responsibility that they do or don't feel for how other people use it. But there are a lot of people who have been in Silicon Valley and contributed to the creation and development of these things who are now kind of defecting and creating new programs or tools or organizations aimed at having healthier relationships with these tools.
When we continue down the journey of things that are available in virtual reality, not just stuff like Planned Parenthood's Across the Line, where you get to see how people respond to actions you are talking about taking, but also who you are. I noticed again, I was reading a December issue of The New Yorker last night, and it also made reference to something you talk about in the book, this VR experience called 1,000 Cut Journey. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was a cool. It was pretty cool when I read that. I was like, "Oh, someone in the New Yorker is doing what I'm doing. I must be smart." So yeah, there's this experience called 1,000 Cuts, and it's where you embody the experience of a young black man through a few different experiences. Specifically, some of them are experiences with racism. Some of it is kind of microaggressions, and some of it is outright racism. And you wear not just a headset, but also a backpack and hand controllers that kind of give it's called haptic feedback to the VR system, and so you can pick things up in the experience and move around in the virtual world. And what I really took away from that was not that, oh, now I understand what it's like to be, you know, I'm a white woman, so it wasn't that I understand what it's like to be a young black man, but it was just how different our experiences are. And it helped me realize that, you know, the empathy that I thought I had for these experiences, it could go deeper. And there is even more that I can't really ever understand. So it kind of showed me the limits there of empathy. But I think that was part of the goal. And Dr. Courtney Cogburn, who created that, she writes a lot about this as well, how she didn't want people to just put it on and walk away and then feel like now they get it. You know, it starts an ongoing conversation.
Well, VR is a tool, as you and many people in the chapter say. I mean, obviously, though, it can be used for ill, too, I would think.
Yeah, and that's definitely a concern. You know, if anything that you can do to trigger empathy in someone, you can also probably manipulate them. And so that's a major concern that a lot of people have, that people are informed about how these things work. And you know, this idea that it's a tool and how it's created definitely plays a role in the impact that it has.
Caitlin, did you get much opportunity to cover how empathy is taught or explained or otherwise referenced in education outside of technology?
A little bit. There's a program called Roots of Empathy that originated in Canada, where they have a family from the neighborhood of the school bring in a newborn baby, and kids kind of get to interact with this newborn baby and see how he or she expresses emotions and the feelings that they have for the child when the child cries or smiles and things like that. And that's been used around the country and in Canada, and has been found to, you know, improve kids' perspective-taking abilities, help them become kinder and more compassionate. So I think that having an explicit focus on social skills like empathy early on has been found to be beneficial for kids.
Talk, if you would, about empathy in the workplace. Let's hear the story of Natalie Egan and what she experienced.
Oh, yeah. So Natalie Egan was an entrepreneur who was living in the world as a man, you know, to anyone who didn't know her. And as she transitioned, she's a transgender woman, she started to notice that she was treated differently in the business world. And that, you know, gave her a whole new, you know, and very profound sense of empathy for a problem that she hadn't really realized was there before. And so she created this organization, this company called Translator, that creates bespoke diversity and inclusion experiences for companies to help people get better at perspective taking and knowing what their coworkers or clients might be going through. So they use virtual reality, but they also use other tools. They have apps and things like that. And this is an area that's really growing, because there's research showing that empathy is really an important communication and performance tool in business. And so I guess it's for a little bit more of a cynical reason than some of the other uses of empathy, but a lot of businesses are now bringing in empathy coaches, and there's an empathy index for which companies, you know, are the best at expressing empathy for their customers and employees. So yeah, that's a growing area.
You mentioned the concern that that virtual reality could be used against, you know, to try to get people to not be empathetic. When we talk about it outside of virtual reality and outside of tech in general, though, I mean, do you have any concerns that empathy would be weaponized by some people, that they would think that if I act like I have empathy, I'll get along better with people or something?
Oh, sure. I think that's always happened. I mean, one thing, you know, famously about, you know, in writing about psychopathy, they say, you know, those people are really great at pretending to have empathy when they don't actually have any. But also empathy and perspective taking, the perspective taking piece is, you know, a big part of politics. It's a big part of advertising, being able to imagine what your audience is experiencing and guess what's going to make them afraid, definitely gives you power over people. So, you know, I don't know that you would really describe that as empathy, but that perspective taking piece has been weaponized, you know, as long as people have been around. And I think that'll continue. And we just need to be aware that with technology, it could be more powerful.
That was an interesting turn of phrase, because when you said that know what the audience wants and knows what they want, and then I thought it was going to turn to hopes, and instead it turned to fears, but you know, which probably says something
about negativity, but yeah.
Right. Yeah. That is where things often go with advertising and politics in particular. You know, instead of encouraging people's hopes, we encourage their fears.
Right.
Let me come back to the workplace for just a moment here, because I want to close this off. And I just wonder if employers are directing workers to engage in tech programs too. I mean, basically, are they spending more time with their faces in computers to learn empathy?
Yeah, that's a good question. That could definitely be the case in some cases. Some of these are sort of hybrid experiences where you get together with a group and part of it is technological and part of it is, you know, experiential. But I think that is definitely a concern. And there was at least some research done showing that one of the best things to make employees more empathetic and better at their jobs and a whole bunch of other benefits is to not keep them at the office or in front of their screens as much, to have more empathy for them. So on the other side of things, you know, some folks are going toward bringing in more technology and some are saying, hey, maybe we should just give people an extra day off.
I kind of like that idea.
Yeah.
Tell us, if you would, Caitlin, about Ellie, a digital avatar who acts as a therapist.
Yeah, so Ellie is a digital avatar, as you said, created by some researchers in California, and I think in collaboration with the VA. And the idea is that she allows people to she assesses a situation of mental health. So she can't be a therapist because an avatar can't go to school and get certifications. But they found in their research and in testing this tool that veterans and soldiers, military personnel, were more comfortable, it seemed, admitting that they were dealing with symptoms of PTSD or depression or anxiety to this avatar first, and then being referred to, you know, to get help. And it seems like it was both the fact that this avatar has human-like attributes and the fact that she's not a human that made people more comfortable. And in addition to listening, you know, and taking in the data, it also does uses some facial recognition technology to kind of see how people's faces are moving while they're talking to her. So it gathers this data and then decides, you know, does this person need to be seen by a human professional?
So as we develop new technologies that remind us that we could, you know, have a little more empathy here and there, it still sort of falls on us. It doesn't sort of, it does fall on us to be responsible for ourselves. And I wonder if you've developed some rules for yourself that you consider sharing with the rest of us.
Yes, I did. I cannot say that I always follow them, but I definitely have been trying to be more mindful about the way I use technology. When I come across new things, there's some questions I ask myself, and these are in the book. How might this improve my life or experience or those of others? What's the potential for manipulation, and are there safeguards? Are the terms and practices transparent and open to critique? And does the technology have a reputation for intentionally harming others?
All right, so a lot of look before you leap in there to be able to assess what it is you're getting into before you get too deep into it.
Exactly.
All right, it's a really thought-provoking book. It's called The Future of Feeling, Building Empathy in a Tech-Obsessed World. It's written by Caitlin Ugolik-Phillips. And again, I noticed a couple of other interviews, including Science Friday in the last week. So thanks for spending time with us today.
Yeah, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right, take care. That will do it for today's exchange. We're online at jeffexchange.org, and I guess I'll skip talking about social media just for today. We're followed by As It Was and The Takeaway in the morning. We're followed by As It Was and BBC News in the evening. Our producers are John Baxter and Angela Decker of JPR News. Student assistant Randy Babbitt's at the controls today. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.